did you find this?
The NFL operates in the fact that, like, $1.4 million, whatever. You know what I mean? Where I'm like, dude, that's life-changing money for my ass. Uh-huh. And Craig.
Yep, and Craig, who's here?
Hello. Penny, for your thoughts?
Penny, for my thoughts is Dorian Thompson-Robertson threw a bomb-ass block for the second week in a row.
The more I've, like, you know that I've only been watching football for a limited time. And, like, before I was like, preseason doesn't matter. But, like, no, preseason's fun as hell because these dudes are literally being, like, this is how I make the job. I'm going to destroy myself for this game that means nothing.
Uh-huh. That's why I think when Ryan was talking about, like, how frustrated he was at the Hall of Fame game, just instead showing, like, you know, some old legend talking without even split-screening into the game. It's like, nah, man, this might be the only time this dude's on TV. Like, I want to see it.
Right.
Or this is the way they get their shot to become a legend, right? Like, I don't care about what Aaron Rodgers has to say. He's in the news all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Don't care. So it's episode 95. We are inching closer to some format changes for TH Fantasy. It was our first post-research episode. We made it, y'all. Thank you. It's a wonderful process. Yeah. We're going to put up a lot of our our writing is going to be reformatted. We're going to put it up as team previews on Football Absurdity. So check it out. I'm proud of the work we've done. You guys, like I said, I feel more prepared than ever. I don't know about y'all.
Yeah.
It's nice to when someone has a take in the Discord and I'm like, hold on, give me 1 second. I just give them fucking 2 pages worth of information. They're like, thumbs up. I still won't draft the guy. I'm like, all right, whatever.
So that's the futility of research. And that's why I love best ball, because I'm like, well, if no one will listen to me, maybe I'll like end up in the money on a couple of these tournaments.
Yeah, I mean, like, we technically do it for ourselves, right? But at the end of the day, like, whoever's listening, I hope they take something from it. But we are sharpening the sword in a way of, like, I'm just here to protect myself, right? Like, if you want to get behind me or beside me and we rush Rohan, cool. But if not, I'm going it alone, right? And that's fine by me.
Well, it's like I realized this today. Ryan and I, like, I know we both listen to the SiriusXM Fantasy Football channel. This time of year, I'm usually trying to cram as much of that content into my life as possible because I want to do my research. But now it's like I don't need to listen to someone else's research because I did my own.
Yeah, right. Like that. Yeah, that's totally true. Like I'll listen to that channel on the way home from work. And like today, like on the way home from work, I was like, you know what? I'm gonna listen to music. When was the last time I did that?
Yeah.
It's like the take this week of like George Pickens is better than Justin Jefferson. And I'm like, okay, factually incorrect, but also please blast that everywhere. So every boomer league I'm in, they do the dumb shit and draft George Pickens way higher than he goes. Right. Like I will take that kind of hot take and like roll it in the opposite way of like, hey, you step on the landmine. I'm good.
Yeah. I think maybe next week, you guys, I think a cool segment would be our landmine flag plants.
So like 85% of the people I researched.
So like, yeah. So like, who are the guys that after we did all the research, no, not predicting for injuries, just straight up like avoid these guys at cost.
Like just rookies?
Anybody.
No, anybody.
Oh, anybody. Okay.
Anybody. So let's, we were a little bit more laid back already on the start. We're just chatting and chilling. Ryan, why don't you start us off with the shorty?
Sure. Yeah. I got a quick shout out. Let's talk about Mr. Roman Pfeiffer.
Ooh, okay.
I like that name.
Yeah. Famously played at UCLA, played with the Rams, the Jets, the Patriots, the Giants, but his mainstay was with the Rams. Let's see. He started for the Rams seasons 1992 to 1998. In his years with the Rams, he played under several different defensive coordinators. His first coach with the Rams featured the Chicago Bears 4-6 style of defense that was brought in by recent Tennessee head coach Jeff Fisher. We all know Jeff Fisher.
We do.
The next season, it changed to a less pressure defense to more of a standard NFL defense. In 1995, that changed again with a new defensive coordinator that introduced the jet defense, where the linemen were in pass rush mode at all times. This helped this guy become a really good defensive player. He's not in the Hall of Fame. He had an average career. But one of the quick things I wanted to talk about him is in 2009, he made his debut into film producing. And he produced his first documentary film. It was called Blood Equity. It covered the lives of several former NFL players, big stars. The film features testimonials from NFL legends like Ditka, Tony Dorsett, Daryl Moose Johnston, Willie Wood, and a lot of others. And it talks about the hardships and struggles of life after football. This Fisher guy always like smoked cigars. And so he was known for his famous, you know, poses and just he was always smoking cigars. But this documentary, the LA Times reviewed the documentary and stated, "Everybody who plays leaves with something. Sadly, that doesn't mean a glorious pension or athletic pride." He was referring to the physical and mental struggles of ex-football players who feel monetary neglected by the now $7.1 billion sport and its union. When, as studies increasingly show, the game's built-in brutality and fierce pride in playing injured leads to post-career life of constant medical care. Blood Equity is distributed by Walking Shadows and is sold in popular online retailers, mainly Amazon. And Pfeiffer made this film in hopes that his message would reach those and talk about rooted NFL players during their playing years. I thought that was pretty cool. Average player who went on to do an impact to talk for, especially these older guys in the league that, you know, don't get a lot of attention anymore. They're just constantly with needing something medically after football, you know, from 30 on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's like the thing people don't talk about either. It's like we all get mad at like, oh, here's this sprain that happened. It screwed my fantasy. But it's like, as someone who like has never had like the unfortunate accident of hurting or tearing a ligament in my knee, like as a normal human being where I don't make my money off of that, I can't imagine the kind of rehab and cost associated with that, where it's like this is this person's entire job and livelihood is now gone because of a freak accident.
Yeah, and as someone who's had their arm severely broken and medically and metally re-put back together like a robot, I can attest that like my arm will never be the same ever again the rest of my life. I'll be good to get back to like 80-90%, but in terms of being like it was before, I'm always going to be scared to lift with that arm.
You fucked my fantasy team by getting into that car accident, dude. You got to come back faster than that. Real quick,
dexterous as a QB,
right? But, real quick before we move on, I got to ask a question to you guys: is the NFLPA the worst union on earth? Like least effective?
I don't know. I don't know a lot of the unions, so it can't be the worst, but it's probably bottom half.
I think like the top end takes care of itself, and then everybody else are like, well, you can eat shit, right? Where it's like, oh, I'm getting my $45 million, but sorry, guy who makes $1 million. That sucks.
Yep. Sucks to suck. All right. Shane, you want to go next?
Yeah. Mine's a little rough. So just a forewarning.
Okay. Oh, no.
Because I originally planned to do Little Giants. I wanted to like do a deep dive in that, but
that
movie was in 94, so I missed it.
Oh.
So I pivoted to The Big Green, and I was just looking through the cast to see whatever, and I was just clicking on Wikipedia articles, and I found out that the dude from Alfalfa is also in the movie, and he's like permafried because he's done so much like huffing of air dust canisters. So
wait, Shane, that's the youth soccer movie, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, real quick before you go further, this is an audio medium. Please remember that, gentlemen. Please raise your hands if you've ever huffed a bunch of air duster. We're not going to talk about whose hands are up. We're just going to go on with Shane's story.
But like, I was like, hey, this is too dark. I'm just going to be ranting and raving, getting mad for an hour. So we're going to go a little somber, but like kind of like Ryan said, of someone who wasn't a superstar, but had their moment in the sun in a different way. So I'm going to talk about the 95 Orange Bowl and specifically about backup quarterback Brooke Berenger.
Ooh. Oh, Nebraska, right?
Correct.
This is indeed a somber story, my friend.
So in the 94 season, after backup Tommy Frazier had a blood clot in his leg, Brooke Berenger, who basically sat on the bench for 2 years, was able to start for seven games, winning seven straight, taking Nebraska to the Orange Bowl. So in those seven game streak before the Orange Bowl, he would throw for 1,300 yards, 10 tutties, and 5 picks. His combined stats from the 2 years before is he only threw 17 passes. So he was basically like put in like the Brock Purdy circumstance of like, hey, here's the big show, make it happen.
Right.
So like I said, they made it to the Orange Bowl, and unfortunately, Frazier was good enough to start for Berenger, but not good enough because he ended up getting benched after throwing a pick in the second series of the game. So Berenger would basically take over and lead the Huskies within 3 points before the coach would again take Berenger out to play Frazier back in the game. The Huskers would go on to win the game 24-17, finish the season 13-0, and win the national championship. So in 95, Berenger would play backup again in his final season in Nebraska, where they would again play in the national championship going back-to-back years. This was the second or the third time, or sorry, they went to the championship 3 years in a row.
Hell yeah.
Even though Berenger was a backup, he was still getting buzz as being selected in the NFL draft in 96. Unfortunately, tragedy would strike as he would die 2 days before the NFL draft in a plane crash as he was flying his private plane over Nebraska, which was caused by a faulty fuel valve and engine failure.
Oh my God, for real?
Yeah. So a memorial service was held at the Red White Spring Game in Nebraska on April 20th, where 48,695 people attended. There's a country band called Sawyer Brown, which they had a track on there, which was track number 18, which was the jersey number that Berenger wore that is dedicated to him on the album Six Days on the Road. And the first live performance of that song took place at the University of Nebraska during the Nebraska State Fair. The lead vocalist, Sawyer Brown, was a pallbearer at Berenger's funeral. And then Berenger was commemorated in Nebraska because the Cornhusker football team established the Brooke Berenger Citizenship Team in honor of him that basically recognizes Cornhusker football players who have shown leadership, involvement, and service above kind of what is asked of them. Yeah. And then in 2006, the University of Nebraska erected a life-size bronze statue of Berenger in front of their athletic complex.
There you go. In nice. Memory.
Yep.
Actually, it's really funny that that's who you pick because my guy next week, who was drafted in the 96 draft, was his running back at Nebraska, Lawrence Phillips. So,
oh, hell yeah.
That we're backfield.
We're always intertwined.
There it is. So awesome. All right, I got a good one for you guys. I'm really excited. This is not a player. This is not a year. Well, it is kind of a year. It's a game. This is a game that took place in 1995. Between the Chargers and the Giants in New York. This is the last week of the season.
Okay.
So this is not worth mentioning as a game because it had major playoff implications, though a Chargers win would eventually lock down a playoff spot. It's not measurable because it was like a crazy good game because the Chargers ended up winning by 10, but because of the fans. So this game has gone down in history as the snowball game, and we're going to talk about one of the dumbest fan incidents in NFL history.
Really?
Okay. Oh, yeah. So this is one of those late season nationally televised Saturday games after the college football season is over.
Sure. Yeah, like and, when they start, like, what, December or whatever?
Yeah. So it was snowing in New York that whole week. The week leading up to the game saw three snowstorms go through the Meadowlands. And the last one dumped somewhere between 9 to 12 inches.
Jesus Christ.
So stadium workers had to come in and work through three storms worth of snow. And the best they could do was clear the seats and paths to the seats as much as possible. So, of course, there's still snow fucking everywhere.
Yeah. Right?
So the game, like the Giants suck. They're 5-10 going into this game. And the fans, like attendance was super low. Everyone that showed up was just wasted because no one cares. And they wanted to just go see a crazy snow game. So the game itself is kind of nuts to start. Chargers starting quarterback Stan Humphries gets knocked unconscious from a sack. the game highlights his videos of just his lifeless body laying there. Players are like walking back towards him like it's time to huddle up.
I hate that on YouTube, dude, where it's like craziest knockouts. And I'm like, that person has brain damage. I'm good.
Yep. Yep. It was just interesting because like if a dude's KO'd today, the training staff is out there in like 10 seconds, unless this is like Tua. But like in the clip I saw, Humphries is just laying there. Like he doesn't exist in this world for like way too long.
Okay.
So sometime early in the second quarter, the Giants get called for holding. And the broadcast, this is the first time you hear the analyst talk about the stadium. Color analyst Chris Collinsworth says, the fans are so passionate, even for a game where nothing is on the line. He doesn't mention what he's referring to, but we know that by that point in the game, fans were throwing snowballs at each other.
Okay.
But since the snow had been sitting there for a week, these packed snowballs were like ice.
Yeah.
So the Giants score a touchdown near the end of the first half to take the lead 17-3. And the fans shower the end zone with snowballs in celebration.
Hell yeah.
And Collinsworth loves it. Play-by-play man Marv Albert, this is pre-sexual assault Marv Albert, of course, mentions that the Giants fans have been throwing snowballs not only in the end zone here, but towards the Chargers bench throughout the first half. Chargers players had stopped taking their helmets off when on the sideline, just to be safe.
Imagine getting concussed in a game, but you're not actually playing in the game. It's because someone throws a fucking ice head or ice bomb at your face.
Stick around. So the Chargers come out in the second half and start whooping ass. Junior Seau and the defense are forcing turnovers. Late in the third quarter, the Chargers backup quarterback throws a deep ball to former podcast subject Tony Martin. Huh?
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
And that pass falls incomplete. But as he's walking back towards the huddle, you can see dozens of snowballs falling all over the field. Just dozens. Between the third and fourth quarter during the TV break, the refs get on the stadium mics and tell the fans that the Giants would have to forfeit the game if they didn't stop. So I got to ask you guys, if the spirit of the Giants fans bent to things like player safety or not being a huge asshole, we wouldn't be telling the story today, would we?
Correct. Sure.
So the Giants get the ball back, and before third down to start the fourth quarter, the officials send both teams to the sidelines, stop the game, and make another announcement that you guys, they're super serious about canceling this game if the Giants fans don't stop. So while this is happening, like the ref is on the sidelines threatening the fans. He's on the San Diego sideline because that's where he's got the phone connecting to the PA person. He doesn't see it because he's bent over on the phone, but inches away from where he is, a giant snowball hits Chargers equipment manager Sid Brooks in the back of the head, knocking him out cold.
Oh my God.
Like, Chargers players, you can tell, are like this close to going into the stands and just Ron Artesting some motherfuckers.
Yeah.
Like, they're like, they have their coats held on top of the passed out equipment manager as they're trying to give him the smelling salts and wake him up. It's nuts.
Like, I'm not one to like promote violence on a recorded medium for posterity, but like, you know what? Maybe some fucking 200-pound, 5'8" guy needs to learn what it's like to get hit by a 300-pound, 6'5". I don't know. I'm just saying.
So the Giants are the score's close. Giants are behind, but they're trying to come back. And their quarterback throws a 99-yard pick six to Charger Sean Gale, former Bear too, by the way. And as he's running down the field, snowballs everywhere, just everywhere. So the Chargers take the lead. The Giants quarterback throws another pick, and then the snowballs get insane. The game ends, and the players all run off the field under a hail of ice balls that were being thrown at both teams, by the way.
That's like a spite fandom of like, we're losing. We threw the game away, but we're going to stay here and just cause as much ruckus as possible.
Uh-huh. So Giants coach Dan Reeves, furious. He's like, if the refs had chosen to cancel the game, I would have absolutely supported that. Giants owner Wellington Mara purchased a full page ad in local San Diego newspapers apologizing for the behavior of their fans. According to reports, security had tried to stop people from throwing snowballs early in the game, but so many of them were doing it that there's just nothing you can do.
What do you do? Throw out the audience? You know what I mean?
That's funny you should mention that because I have some stat totals for you here. 10 injured security guards.
Damn.
15 injured fans.
Damn.
14 arrested fans.
Damn.
And 175 people ejected from the stadium.
Dude, this is like the Dunkirk of fucking football games.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. So before we go, I want to talk about a guy named Jeffrey Lang. All right. At some point during the game, a photographer from the Associated Press got a picture of a dude throwing a snowball and put it on the front page of the paper.
Okay. All right?
The Giants offered a $1,000 reward for anyone providing information on who he was.
Okay.
15 people snitched on old Jeffrey Lang.
Oh, shit.
15 people.
They get stitches now.
So, right, so he gets arrested. And there's a hilarious bit because he goes on, he does the media rounds, whatever, and there's an article written about him. And he says that he was upset by the number of people that turned him in.
Yo, if that many people snitch on you, you're just not liked.
Right, right, right. And I have a quote from him. Quote, "It's annoying what money can do to people." End quote.
Wow.
So he pleads innocent to charges of improper behavior and gets convicted. He had to pay a fine of $650. He appealed, claiming that the publicity got him fired from his job and discriminated against.
Oh, shit.
The old Josh or John Gruden ploy.
I don't. Does he not know what the word discrimination means? Anyways.
Really not.
So he gets the ruling's upheld. Fuck you. Pay the fine. So he plays victim in the media. He acts like he can't believe he was singled out. He said he felt like a piece of meat left out in front of the Lions. I get it. He's not the only person who threw snowballs, but like, if you're not willing to find out, you can't fuck around.
Yeah.
So before we leave the snowball game for good, I want to point out one last thing. Since the game was in shit weather and the Giants sucked that year, most people gave their tickets to other people. Our pal Jeffrey Lang was actually a Bills fan, which is bizarrely on brand.
And you know what sucks is, like, if you're like a season ticket holder and bad shit happens in your seat, you get your tickets revoked.
Sure do.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so that's the snowball game.
Didn't that happen last year in the playoff game between the Christmas game,
yeah,
between Buffalo and
there was. You're right, Shane. Dolphins. There was a game where people were throwing snowballs, something.
And
like
they got on the PA. They're like, "Hey, don't do it. We're gonna cancel the game."
Yeah, it had to have been a Bills game.
Yeah, it's pretty on brand.
That was great, Tony.
Take us home, Ryan.
All right, really quick, I got another shorty. I wanted to talk about Mr. Bryce Paup, PAUP. All right, former outside linebacker. Played with the Green Bay Packers, the Bills, Jacksonville, and Minnesota. Played for like four seasons with the Packers, then a few seasons with the Bills. He had a decent coaching career. He's from Iowa, so I thought that was cool. But he didn't go to University of Iowa. He went to University of Northern Iowa.
Boo.
Right. And he currently still lives in Cedar Falls, which is just north of University of Iowa. He had some interesting flashes in his career. In 95, after he got traded to the Bills from the Packers, he was named the NFL Defensive Player of the Year by the AP. He led the NFL that year with 17 and a half sacks as a linebacker.
No shit.
Yep. That is the fourth highest single season total of the 1990s.
That's awesome.
Right? He's considered to be one of the top 50 Bills players in their franchise history. He got traded so much that he was listed as one of the top 10 free agents of all time. And that year he did get a Pro Bowl selection, obviously, and he was a four-time Pro Bowler. Funny story, which I started reading about this guy and I'm like, this is the best name. This is the best name ever. All right. So in his first game of the 1991 season, he was involved in a tackle that sidelined Philadelphia Eagles quarterback Randall Cunningham, ending his season. The tackle was below the waist and right at Cunningham's knee, which obviously, like I said, ruined his entire 91 season. So his aggressive physical style led Packers fans to refer this type of tackle as the pap smear, the pop smear. Oh, that was so funny.
Locker room talk.
He's been a coach for high schools. He's been a coach for the University of Minnesota. Most of these are like defensive line coaching positions.
Sure.
And I believe currently right now he is the University of Northern Iowa defensive line coach. Did a few stints at some Wisconsin high schools, but now and then he did University of Minnesota, and yeah, now he's in Northern Iowa University. So that's Mr. Pop Smear, Bryce Pop.
Let's go. That's wonderful. All right. So those are our guys. We did our 95s. We'll come back at you with we got a couple segments on the other side of this little short break. So we'll be back in a second. And goodbye.
This is a whole new level of survival, and we're trying to film it.
I commend anyone who can survive in this area.
There's a bear right across.
I feel like I'm starving.
I didn't come here to get killed.
It's gonna be hell.
It's so loud up there.
Hey, bear!
My man. All right, we are back. So, one of the things that all three of us enjoy is a TV show called Alone. I love it because like it always makes me feel like I got it really good because I'm not freezing in the middle of the fucking woods.
I'm not trying to eat a tree.
Yeah.
To survive.
They did it to themselves. I mean, they chose to accept the challenge.
You're trying to win money. I think my favorite part about that show is like the show's great, seasons are great, you can talk about it, whatever, but like the cultural implication that it has, where like I go to the barbershop and some like 50-year-old guy is like, dude, I could win that shit easy. And I'm like, sir, yeah, you're in flip-flops here. Yeah. Like, I don't want to hear it. I would last like maybe 2 days on that show. I'd be like, you know what? This was fun, but I'm good. I want to take a shower. Goodbye.
There's been a lot of interesting strategies on that show. From one guy I remember seeing like a few seasons ago, he's just like, screw it. Like these last few seasons, I just watch these people like dwindle away to nothing because you're not getting a lot of protein. They lose a lot of weight. So this guy's like, I'm going to gain like 70 pounds before he won this. And he was like, and it worked. He made it almost all the way to the end, or maybe he won. He either got second or first. I can't remember, but and when you saw him, you're like, this guy's like almost 300 pounds. This guy's not going to fucking survive. He can't even walk. And he made it just because of the pure fact he was eating fish and eating protein, but you just don't get enough out there on a daily basis where your body just starts eating itself away.
Well, right. It's like Sam. I think he was on season 1 and 4, the kind of little pudgy dorky kid. You're like, oh, this guy's just like Augustus Gloop from Willy Wonka. And then like, the last week, you're like, oh, dude, that's a grizzled Adonis now. He's only been eating fucking mice for the last 6 weeks.
I just like it because a bunch of doomsday prepper survivalist right libertarians get fucking smoked by nature.
Yep.
But since we're all big fans of Alone, instead of doing like a traditional flag plant segment, we are going to do something that the contestants on Alone get to do. And so when you go to Alone, you get to bring a pack of items.
10 items from a list.
And so we've decided for you, our loyal listeners, we are going to present to you our survival packs for the 2023 fantasy football season. So we'll go one by one. We'll go around and you'll tell me your item and what player represents that item to you. Ryan, you've spent the longest in the woods out of the three of us, so why don't you start?
Sure, I'll go first. So my first item that I'm going to pick for this segment is going to be a fishnet. And that wasn't really an item until like the last, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 seasons that they were allowed it. But so a fishnet is a great tool, especially on the water. You can, it's set it and forget it. You know, you put it in the water, you let it sit all day, and you check it once a day, you know,
just spawn camping resources.
Right. Yeah. And maybe there's a fish, maybe there's two. Sometimes you get skunked. Sometimes there's nothing. All right.
Or a bird.
But on the whole, it's consistent. You know, it's going to provide, it's something that doesn't take a lot of calories out of your body to catch protein. So my fishnet for this segment is going to be Najee Harris. All right. Because okay. he's going to be consistent in supplying that food source, AKA fantasy points. At the end of the day, at the end of the week, it'll be consistent. Like I said, you're going to have more successful days with this fishnet than not. With any player, you're going to have those few down weeks, but you're going to end up at the end of the week. You're going to be consistent with points with Najee Harris this week. So he's my fishnet.
And I think that's the thing, Art, is like, what's Najee's projected points per week? 15? Like, I'm not upset with that, right? Like, it's boring, yeah, right. And it's not going to win you the week. And he will have boom weeks when the Steelers score their magical 21 points once a season.
Right.
But like you said, he's just reliable. Perfect running back too. Just like pick him up in like at the turn of the second to third round. If he falls to you later, like, I think he's great there.
Though the improvements to the offensive line are fucking huge. The fact that they drafted a sixth offensive lineman at tight end is huge.
Have you been seeing those highlights of him just fucking lumbering across the field? Just do like these one-handed catches. I'm like, that's never happening in the NFL. I don't know who thinks this is real. But it's cool highlights, but I'm like, yo, dog, this guy's moving through molasses right now.
Right. All right, Shane, you want to go next?
Yeah, I'm going a little bit more dangerous. I'm going with my axe, right? Like, even though the axe is a staple, it is a little dangerous. And I want to say my guy comparison to that is Jahmyr Gibbs.
Oh, nice.
Because I'm bringing my axe, like Gimli in Lord of the Rings. So an axe in alone is basically a staple that allows participants to forage efficiently as well as build a shelter that can be game breaking if done properly. I know, like, as the seasons progress, like, people have like lived in a tarp and made it, and then like as seasons go along, like, people making fucking houses with like chimneys and like smoke houses, right. And they're just like breaking the game.
Yeah, that guy on the last season made like a bellows and a fire out of clay. It was so cool, and stone.
Yeah,
it's like no one's made a hearth like before that, I don't think.
Or the guy in the snow who killed that whole buffalo by himself and was like, hey, I have to make this freezer for all this meat I got. So to me, Gibbs is one of the sharpest blades in fantasy this year in the mid round. Yeah, it's high. I know some of us are out on him at cost. And I don't blame you because for me, the projections that we've seen with historical top 12 draft picks in the actual NFL have a positive outlook, and I'm willing to take that risk in that range of picks. I'm also kind of at the point in draft seasons when I'm willing to reach and grab him. I don't really care at this point because the way that my picks kind of line up is he's usually my RB1. And if I'm playing for sealing it the third round, I think that's kind of what I want to do. There is a caveat to this, obviously, because as we've seen in Alone, people will get yoinked from the show because they will absolutely fuck their shit up with their axe because they miss and then they bleed out and need stitches. Where Gibbs has the ability to do that, right? Of like, if he doesn't hit these projections that we've made for him of like basically replicating the Swift production because he's a different style of player, your third round pick could just blow up in your face, right?
You can. I mean, it's not a death sentence in the third round. It's really not.
It's not, but it's also like comparatively to other things you can do in the third round of like taking like the safe floor of like Aaron Jones or
Najee.
Yeah, exactly. So Gibbs is definitely kind of towing the line for me in that way, where things can go right really easily, or it can end your season if things go wrong. But for me, I'm willing to build a little nice pretty house to sit in.
All right. Love that. Let's stick with the Detroit backfield, because I am going with David Montgomery, and the item that he symbolizes to me is a pair of wool socks.
Nice.
David Montgomery, he's a volume play. I think even the people like Shane, who's you're incredibly high on Gibbs, I'm assuming you also believe that there's fantasy value there for Montgomery as well.
It sucks because when you draft Gibbs, you're always presented with Monty in the fifth. And I don't like taking my own handcuffs here, but I do think, like you said last year, like this is a different circumstance, but like there comes a point when there's two running backs in a room that are viable, like AJ Dillon and Aaron Jones, where I think this year they do such different things where I'm not worried about them eating into each other's production. I think they're both perfectly fine in the way that they can operate. One just has a higher ceiling and one is a bigger risk, right?
Yeah.
It's third to fifth round ADP.
Yep.
Jamal Williams had 38 carries in goal to go situations last year. Second place was 22. If Monty goes down to 22, he's still a top three in terms of goal to go carries, and he's a good tackle breaker.
And that's going to be a high scoring offense too.
He can catch passes. Last year he had 12 carries per game, but he usually gets between 17 to 19. And since the Lions are a zone run offense, Monty's strength is the zone run. I don't think they're going to be running Gibbs up the middle. So when they run their inside zone, it's going to be David Montgomery. He's got his best offensive line he's ever had. And like, it's the wool socks, right? Like, you don't think about him. You put him on and you leave him there until you either wash yourself off or something goes horribly, horribly wrong. They're consistent. They're giving you that level of comfort that like you need in order to do the tasks that you go to survive. I think Montgomery's a foundational piece, just like in the way I think wool socks might be underrated, but you can't survive without them.
Yep. And if they get wet, sometimes you got to stick them by the fire and let them dry out.
Please do not wet David Montgomery.
Right. All right. So my next item we're going to do for this segment is going to be my magnesium fire starter. All right.
Okay.
We all know that fire burns at, you know, famously 451 degrees. That's the minimum temperature you need to have to start a fire, right?
I learned something today.
Magnesium, on the other hand, which is why, you know, it's one of those little sticks that you shave little pieces off and you try and get a spark going. Magnesium burns at 10 times that. It burns at 4,000 degrees, which is why it's the element used in all these survival fire starters, because when you get enough flakes off and you get a spark, it'll literally ignite any tinder that you have there.
That's what that Bruce Springsteen song's about, right?
No, well, I would imagine that Bruce Springsteen can't start a fire in the wilderness by himself.
I hate Bruce Springsteen. If he's the boss, I quit.
Unionize.
So I'm going with my narrative with the Jacksonville Jaguars, and I'm not believing. I'm the antithesis of Calvin Ridley. My magnesium fire starter is Christian Kirk, all right? Because he's going to burn hot all year. All right.
Oh, I love this.
Anything you want to add?
I love Kirk. I think I think what we've seen over the last couple of weeks has been a gradual increase in people recognizing Christian Kirk as like someone worth rostering, someone worth taking a shot on.
Got a touchdown in that first preseason game.
I think people have also kind of cooled down on Calvin Ridley, right? Like, I think people are starting to realize like, oh yeah, he's pretty expensive and we're kind of drafting him at his ceiling, right? Like if you're taking him again in the third round, like a Gibbs, like you're projecting this guy to put up 1200 yards, eight touchdowns, just to hopefully meet that point where we've been on Kirk the whole off season.
And oh yeah, Ridley hasn't played for 2 years and he's on a completely different team now.
All right, I want to ask you a question because I'm looking back at the Dynasty League, the industry Dynasty League that we drafted our startup in this summer. We took Christian Kirk over Amari Cooper, Jameson Williams, and Jahan Dotson. Any regrets?
No.
As of right now, no. Like, Dotson might be, like, the difference maker if Caleb Williams comes to town, right? But, like, outside of those people, I don't really care about Amari Cooper. How much longer does he actually have as like a viable fantasy asset? JMO to me, I'm like, I'm so glad I sold my shares. But yeah, I don't have any regrets in that decision at all.
All right. All right, Christian Kirk. I love it. People were talking like, oh my God, did you see in the preseason game he wasn't in three receiver sets? Motherfucker, you know how the slot position works?
Right?
No. My guy needs to be out there. Justin Herbert didn't play the first snap. Fucking Max Duggan is the new quarterback, right?
Like, there it is.
It doesn't matter. Like, the only thing I want to watch during preseason is the way the scheme is playing out. I don't give a fuck who's playing it. Like, I think it was when the tight end for the Vikings were touchdown. I was like, that's a Hockenson play. It's the same route he's going to run every season. I don't give a shit who the guy is scoring touchdown right now. It's just lateral.
Yep. All right, Shane, what do you got?
Dude, we're sticking with Detroit.
Oh, my God.
I got Amon-Ra St. Brown. He's my tarp.
Ooh, okay.
Kind of a dual strat with the tarp in the show. Very viable. Not everybody uses it or brings it because they don't think it's that important, but it's something that can provide a stability of a floor for a sleeping arrangement, a wind blockade for a shelter, or if you're like Psycho Sam I talked about earlier, it's just your shelter itself.
And you can use a tarp for literally anything. You could make a boat with a tarp. Like you said, use it as a wind shelter. You use it as a floor. It has so many things you could do with it.
Where to me, Amon-Ra St. Brown is that player, right? Like he covers the spectrum of what I want in a early to mid round, second round wide receiver. He can either be the best wide receiver two that is in the NFL, or he can be potentially your wide receiver one, depending on the way you start your team, right? Like if you start with a Kelce, a Bijan, a Saquon, I would not ever be apprehensive about having Amon-Ra St. Brown being my wide receiver one, because I know he provides me a utility of 7 to 10 targets a game, 140 targets per year. Like I'm not concerned about Laporta. I'm not concerned about J-Mo in there. Like he's going to get his, it doesn't matter. Like people have been out on him for 2 years are finally going to have to realize after this year to be like, okay, he's the real deal. Right. And like, I'm comfortable putting my season against the elements this year with my tarp of Amon-Ra St. Brown. He's a good start to the season. So he'll see an immediate return in the first 3 or 6 games. As J-Mo's gone, Laporta's acclimating to the offense. They're trying to figure out what's going on. And he's going to basically give you a solid floor to protect you against like a downpour of bad weeks, bye weeks, or anything of like your other players having volatile weeks, right? So you can play ceiling plays with the other guys in that thing where he's reliable to me, and I want reliability at that point. And he can kind of do it all. And that's why I want to have my foundation or my multiple utility, like Ryan said, based upon Amon-Ra St. Brown.
Love it. Huge Amon-Ra guy. Amon-Ra St. Brown finished the year as a top 6 wide receiver.
Top 6? Yeah, I think so.
Shane and Ryan, question for you. Who is second on the Detroit Lions in targets when the season is over?
Sam Laporta.
Ooh.
Okay.
Yeah, I think
really?
So.
I would go Gibbs. I'm going Gibbs.
It's going to be close. It's within like 5, right? One's going to have like 85. One's going to have like 79.
Okay.
I mean, you could maybe with some injuries throw in Josh Reynolds.
You never know. Yeah, he's still there.
Yeah, he's still there. He had, what, 59 targets last year? And that was because of injuries, I think. But.
All right. So I am going to talk about a forgotten piece of the Alone pack, and also a player that you can get cheap for no reason at all in my mind. And I've made no bones about this. My carabiner is Jerick McKinnon. Easy.
I like it.
Easy. McKinnon, we all talked about it. Second pass option in Kansas City. Last year, Kansas City backs were 9th in reception, 2nd in receiving yardage, 1st in touchdowns. He had the 2nd most red zone targets. He was 3rd in the league in red zone snap percentage. Like, we're talking top 10 in targets, catches, receiving yards per game, yards per target, yards per reception, yards after the catch, yards after the catch on a per reception level. He had 9 receiving touchdowns last year.
Damn.
He was 5th among all backs in designed reads. So they're trying to get him the ball.
Sure.
He's going to cost you weeks. I'm not stupid. Like, he's going to have weeks where he puts up 6 points.
But like the thing, right, is like, are you ever going to put him in your RB1, RB2 slot, right? Like he's a safe flex to me, right?
Sure. I guess for me, when I think about it, like if you step back and you remove all the names and profiles of all of the Kansas City pass catchers, regardless, Jarvis Kelce doesn't exist. He's tight end one, whatever. Wide receiver one, wide receiver two, whatever. And Patrick Mahomes stays the same. You would pay a price for the second pass catcher in Kansas City. You would buy that player in the fifth round.
Which people are trying to do in the later rounds by forcing things that we know have not proven to be quality assets, where Jerick McKinnon, proven asset.
And so, like, Jerick McKinnon to me is sixth round value being drafted in the ninth or tenth. And just like a carabiner, like, you're not really thinking about it. You're not going into alone thinking, how is this carabiner going to help me? But when you don't have it, you need it. Period. Right.
Yeah.
And so when the season goes on, the season gets long and it starts to be December, Jerick McKinnon once again is going to come in and kill it. And I think he's got league winner at cost written all over him again for a second straight year. Isaiah Pacheco's not catching passes.
No.
So that's my carabiner is Jerick McKinnon.
All right. So the last item on my list for today is going to be paracord. All right. Paracord is so versatile. I went with versatility like Shane did with his last guy.
Sure.
You can use it to make shelter. You can, you know, tie tarps together. You can use it as in a frame for a boat. You can even break down paracord into individual strands to use for sewing if your shelter gets torn, or you can even use it for fishing line. All right. So we're talking about someone that's very versatile, and that versatile quarterback this year for me is going to be Jalen Hurts. All right.
Okay.
Such a versatile quarterback. He's going to make AJ Brown blow up. He's going to rush for a bunch of touchdowns. He's going to have a bunch of rushing yards. He's going to hopefully replicate what he did last year and maybe even better. And because of his versatility on the field and his ability to scramble, he is going to be my paracord.
There's like, if you told someone tomorrow, I come from the future, Jalen Hurts will end quarterback one in fantasy points per game. I feel like a good 75% of people would be like, yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
Sure. I'm going back to June when I covered the Eagles and I'm shaking my own hand.
Right. Like it's a perfectly reasonable expectation because those runs are scrambles, but those runs are also designed runs, and those tend to stay sticky from year to year.
Over 100 designed runs last year. Over 100.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. He will be like, his floor is what, quarterback three if he stays healthy?
Correct. That's crazy. I love it.
Period.
All right. Mine is not exciting, but mine is something that everybody takes. Nobody ever doubts what they take because it's boring and it keeps you warm at night. Mine is the sleeping bag. Okay. And it's mine because everybody's sleeping on this guy, Miles Sanders.
There we go.
Ooh.
So if you want my real breakdown of Miles Sanders, go listen to 93.5, the first full statistical reason of why I believe Miles Sanders can, at baseline, meet your ADP decision of at the fifth round with the possibility of having the upside of winning you your league.
Right? Y'all better listen to this too. Shane did a really good job with Carolina.
Sanders is that guy for me because he's super unsexy, but as my RB2 or potentially first running back on my team, depending on my build in the fifth round, he gives me top 15 upside yet again, is what's going to keep my season alive by giving me a really stable floor and letting the other positions of my team kind of catapult me when they all kind of culminate together to give me the amount of points that go burr and I win. And as much as we love ceiling plays, I think he's a serious lock for four play that will give you a minimum of his ADP value. And like I said, in return more, he's boring, but those 14 points per week we'll let you get up and get ready and go to the next week as you chug along to the playoffs.
I mean, didn't we say when Ryan was talking Najee, what does he get you? 15 points a week? Yep. In round 2-3 turn, whereas Miles Sanders might get you within one fantasy point per game and you can get him two rounds later.
And that's like what's frustrating to me is because like I feel like, not that I don't like Najee, but like if Najee didn't have his rookie year, he'd be in the Miles Sanders tier, right? Like if he wasn't just force fed all those passes by the noodle arm rapist of Ben Roethlisberger, he'd have a much lower ADP because people are still trying to replicate that, right? They're trying to be like, oh, he did it one time, he could do it again, where it's like Miles Sanders is the opposite, where his career has gone in a different trajectory of like he was a pass catching running back in the very beginning before Hurts came into play. And then he became a preliminary between the tackles guy, where he has shown that he can do both. And that's kind of why I'm in on it. Like, yeah, it's a part of his game. It's not his main facet of his game, but it's there. And it's kind of the sword is sheathed. And you know what I mean? Like, so I don't have much to lose in the fifth round. So fuck it. We ball.
Right.
What I really want to see when the fantasy season is done, and we can all look back, I want to see what players were rostered on the highest percentage of championship teams.
Yeah, correct.
And I wouldn't be surprised if a couple of these guys are on those teams. I got one more. And this one it's a little bit different. I'm going to think a little outside the box here. There's an item that I know has been talked about, but I can't remember any time that it's been talked about on Alone. And it's a crucial piece to a different part of struggle. I'm going to bring one personal photograph.
It's got to be black and white, though.
Classic. And my one personal photograph is Justin Fields.
Oh, shit.
Is it going to be stained or?
I mean, depends. All right. So
is Waleed there with you?
so let's back up. And
you better laminate that shit.
Let's talk about the Bears offense before the bye last year. The NFL average quarterback sack percentage was 6.5. Justin Fields was at 16.7.
What? It was that bad?
Yeah. He was getting sacked on 16.7 of his dropbacks.
Wally did not believe me when he listened to the episode. He's like, because I got the message on Discord. So I listened to the Bears episode. I'm like, well, there goes my relationship with everybody right now. And he's like, no, these stats are like game-breakingly bad, right? Like terrible. Like carry on.
Yes. So Darnell Wright, pick 10. Nate Davis brought in to play right guard. Tevin Jenkins at left guard. Like there's a chance this offensive line takes a step forward. Not a giant step forward, but based on how bad they were last year, there's no place to go but up.
Right.
I have that whole number wall of stats comparing Justin Fields year two to Jalen Hurts year two. I'm not projecting a Jalen Hurts level ascension this year because the line is still like, you know, the off-brand version of the Eagles, and the wide receiver room is the off-brand version of the Eagles.
Right, they're not great.
But I think they're that's right. A fair assessment, right? It's like it's not Jalen Hurts, but it's the Walmart version of the Target brand of Jalen Hurts, right?
Right. And so DJ Moore's a stud. Mooney as a wide receiver too, like not for fantasy purposes, but for real life purposes, lets him do what he's best at. Chase Claypool being the contested catches guy and being the slot guy and having the backfield filled to the brim with capable skill position players. Like, even if I think he rushes less, I think he's gonna be rushing from design plays and with a receiver room that's so good that it's harder for a defense to assign a spy to Fields.
Yeah. Well, I mean that's why the Eagles are so successful is because they didn't know who to look for.
Right. And so like the same reason I love Derrick Henry this year after the addition of DeAndre Hopkins is the same reason I love Justin Fields with the addition of DJ Moore. There's going to be less people crowded around the line because Dante Pettis, Equanimeous St. Brown, and N'Keal Harry aren't going to be the wide receivers.
Right.
So I'm huge on Fields. I think Fields wins way more games than he deserves to this year. He is my personal photograph, And at night when things feel dire, I can just take that out of my pocket and just take a look and just sigh pensively.
This is what I play fantasy for.
There it is. Those are the 9 items that I think. Shane, do you have a 10th? Do you want to throw a 10th in there?
I don't.
Okay. We don't need 10.
AJ Brown is my $100,000 when I go home and win.
Just all so right. I can... Well, I'll throw one out there. Shane, who's going to be your bow? Who's going to be your bow and arrow? Who's gonna get you that kill every like 4 or 5 weeks?
I think it's AJ Brown, man. Like, I hate to go back to it, but like, he's gonna have like 30-point weeks where it's like he's got 3 tutties in the game, right? Like, he plays shit secondary, and instead of doing 2 points to the Steelers secondary, he points at 3.
Okay. Good game. I've been rewatching Red Zone lately.
Such a degenerate, dude. There's preseason games.
Uh-huh. And
I recorded the Bears preseason games.
There you go. And so
Justin Fields looked good in those 3 passes he threw. Yeah. 128 yards for 2 touchdowns.
158 quarterback passer rating.
I watched the game last year where AJ Brown played the Titans and he caught a 40-yard touchdown pass and they called it incomplete. So then on the next play, he caught a 40-yard touchdown pass.
That was awesome.
I was like, this dude, this fucking guy. All right, so we got 2 more segments. And Shane, why don't you intro what you're about to do? I'm really excited here.
All right, so last week when we talked about what the sweatier hobby is Magic the Gathering? Or yeah, so correct. I'm gonna out myself in this sphere of being a big ass nerd and also a non boob toucher because I like Magic the Gathering and fantasy football, right? So if you thought fantasy football was a nerd hobby, Magic the Gathering is like the king of nerd hobbies. Like, maybe Warhammer surpasses that in regards to like how much it takes monetarily, attention wise, lore, shit, whatever. So I'm gonna basically explain to me 2 of my favorite Magic decks of all time for as long as I've been playing. I took a hiatus after COVID hit. And I transitioned to fantasy football because I need that fixation to keep my brain occupied. But also, fantasy football, for the way I play it, is a lot cheaper than playing Magic the Gathering. So it's been nice to my bank account as well.
Correct.
So I'm going to correlate my 2 favorite Magic the Gathering decks. I'll break them down the way they play, kind of stylistically, how you beat your opponent, how you build your deck style, and then how that correlates with drafting strategies I've employed this season.
Okay.
I like it.
So the first one, I'm going to go with an all-time classic in Magic the Gathering, where if you tell any like somewhat competitive player or anybody who's like been involved in the scene at some point, they know what a true terror of one of the formats called Modern is. Formats in Magic are basically based upon certain set releases. So certain formats will have from like 2012 to current, 1998 to 2006, whatever. Certain cards are banned, blah, blah, blah. One of those decks is called Jund. So decks have basically a code name to signify what they are, to explain to like in layman's terms, instead of being like, oh, I'm red blue control, it's just like, okay, I'm this. So there's different styles of deck: aggressive, control, combo, or mid-range. Jund is based on lore within the game, and it is a mid-range deck, which basically means you're trying to play a longer game with trading resources, because Magic the Gathering is a resource-based game where you have to pivot your resources into trying to capitalize on your opponent and kind of outpace them to bring their life total down to 0 and win. Where Jund is, you're trying to outpace the opponent and trades enough resources where you enter the point where you turn the corner and you basically shut the door on the game, while still threatening life total and drawing better cards and eliminating threats and basically eliminating speed bumps. So I'm going to kind of break down the way that Jund plays, because this is kind of how these draft styles play too, because you see similar patterns within slots of drafts and kind of how teams are built.
Okay.
So games with a Jund basically start off, you play land, you use your land to cast color to play a spell. Those cards, generally, Jund starts with a card called Thoughtseize or Inquisition of Kozilek that allows you to look at your opponent's hand and remove cards from their hand that may be problems in your game plan. And this is kind of like when you play at the later end of the draft, is you are seeing how the board is shaping out, you're seeing who's falling, who's going to be projected to you at the turn, so you can kind of make your moves accordingly and kind of based on your trajectory of how your team should be built going forward. So you have that kind of advantage of, you don't get the top tier player, but you know how to structure yourself in that way. So the second turn in Jund is basically a creature where you can apply pressure to the board to prevent your life total being damaged, or being aggressive as you can start eliminating threats with removal spells or whatever, or you play with another hand control spell or removal spell to preserve your own life total, which is kind of how you do in the later halves, is you pick a higher end player like an Amon-Ra St. Brown, a Devontae Adams, Derrick Henry, to kind of either push aggression or provide yourself with a nice floor of how to build your team.
Sure.
The third turn of Jund is usually ends up being a card that is a permanent fixture on the board called the Planeswalker, and it's a real pain in the ass. I know if you talk to like old heads, they actually like hate that card type because it's like you can only attack it directly. You can't like remove it with like a spell or whatever. Like you have
right.
to, like they have like certain things, but it's or like you can do different things that like you can never remove like an emblem. So what's like once the you tick it up enough times, it becomes a permanent fixture that stays there forever, which is like, oh, you have to sacrifice a creature every turn or you lose the game. Stuff like
right,
that.
Right, right,
right. So this style of deck is personally my favorite because it's a long grinding chess game where you're trying to trade resources enough and outsmart your opponent, which I really like to do because I have that weird like hater in my brain of like, hey, you should step on this person. Okay. But I'm also too stupid to play chess, so this is kind of how I navigate my way with this. So the way I envisioned a Jund deck in drafting for fantasy football is basically you're between the 8th and the 12th draft slot because you're stacking really good players as they fall. So you can have a Saquon, a Diggs, AJ Brown into Adams, Derrick Henry, Nick Chubb. So some of them aren't super sexy compared to where they can be in regards to breaking fantasy because you have a lower quote unquote pick, but they are reliable assets that are worth their point of entry and provide tremendous upside to you to help you build your team and win your week, while also giving you a very high floor that allows you to kind of insulate yourself when things do go wrong and gives you a nice comfort zone in regards to what happens.
Okay.
So you're not really getting burned or hung out to dry based on consistency. As these drafts progress, you're basically taking guys with their safest upside that won't crush your season, like an Aaron Jones or over a Jahmyr Gibbs or a Tyler Lockett over Jordan Addison. You know what these players are, what they provide you week to week. They aren't sexy, but they are going to basically supersede their return on investment of compared to ADP. They're always going to outperform that value. They will provide you 30-point games, like in Magic. Some of these guys will just take away the game, and you just smash. And then sometimes they all accumulate to make a team that gives you 150 points in 1 week in PPR.
Right.
So I won't say this is really a safe style of play because it's not. It's more of a value play style where you're taking players that will outperform their ADP, just like in Jund, that will outweigh their return of investment and for the amount of mana or the draft picks you have in the game. This style of play is utilizing the board advantage to you and taking players that will return investment at a higher rate than other players, cumulative for your whole team compared to the next style, which I'm going to talk about. So if you guys want to meditate on that, we can talk about that.
I like the idea of the flexibility. Do you want this deck to be a control deck? Do you want it to be a XYZ? And like whenever anybody asks on the Discord, Ryan, I don't know how you feel about this, but like when they're like, who do you like at the end of the first turn, picks 12 and 13? And my answer is always whoever's there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whoever's value.
Like when I first started grinding best ball drafts this year, it was like Saquon Barkley. And now it's Nick Chubb or Derrick Henry or, you know, T. Higgins or whoever, or CeeDee Lamb, Stephon Diggs, Devontae Adams. Like I love it because I don't have to commit.
Yeah. You're given what you're given and you make the best out of it. We're like,
right.
Magic and these style of decks, and as well as fantasy, have taught me the gas pedal of when to go in and when to press back, when to play it safe, when to play aggressive, as well as staying fluid, right? You have to be malleable and you have to navigate the way of, you have to zig when people zag. You have to understand, oh, this is the way the board is shaping out to be. I need to get ahead of this, or I need to get my guy because I know there's going to be something happens where I'm going to be stuck with the lowest possible tier, or the highest guy in the lowest possible tier coming up because the way that the board is shaping out. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Okay. So I like that idea. I like the idea of that type of deck. What else you got for us? So you got one more?
I got one more.
Let's do it.
So for those that aren't aware, Magic the Gathering is a life total versus life total game where you have to basically get your opponent to zero. There's obviously other win conditions, but that is like the simplest way to do it. So within that way, life is a resource that can be used to draw extra cards, remove creatures from the games, and sometimes power up your own creatures to push you over the edge with damage. So this deck is actually my favorite of all time. I've played many decks in Magic, but this is just my favorite because it's like, it has everything that I want. It does aggro, it does control, it does, you play a mid-range. This deck is called Death Shadow. Again, another like Jund, right? It has its own code name, and it hinges around this creature card called Death Shadow. This whole purpose of this deck is similar to Jund, but with the fattest line of coke you've ever taken in your life.
Hell yeah.
So you purposely lower your life total through cards that also benefit you, like Thoughtseize, which makes you pay 2 life. So you remove a card from their hand, you pay 2 life. You're bringing your life total down to a certain frame. So, or you remove a creature by paying X life to do X amount of damage. Because the creature that is in this deck is Death Shadow, that has a base power based upon how low your life total is. So if you are at 1 life left and you're about to lose the game, this creature has 13 power. So you basically hit with that creature twice and you win the game. So this deck does play very similar to Jund, because you're trading resources and you're outvaluing your opponent while having a tremendous threat and a clock against your opponent, because there's a card called Temur Battle Rage, which is an instant spell that allows you, which you can play at any time. So when you go to combat in Magic, you can basically bluff your opponent to be like, hey, I'm attacking with these two guys. They have one blocker. They have to pick. And then you play it at instant speed and be like, I want to give this creature double strike, which double strikes means it does double damage. And right. Then if your creature has a certain amount of power, it also has trample, which means that damage goes through. So yep. if your creature has that you're defending against has a toughness of 5 and your creature has a power of 13 and you hit it with trample double strike and you have an unblocked creature, you just win the game in one turn.
That's so OP.
Yeah. But again, you play this caveat of this very fine line dance of how low do I take my life total? When do I press the gas pedal? And like some matchups you have, like if you're playing like a quote unquote burn deck, which basically just throw 3 damage at you every turn and you're like, okay, I'm just going to lose this shit. Mm-hmm. These decks can basically win on turn three or four, depending on how you start. It's a very skill intensive game that it requires you to basically ride the razor's edge of analysis and predicting what's going to happen while also playing to your ceiling. So the way this relates to fantasy is we've talked about not playing for 6th place. I don't want to come in 3rd. That shit's stupid. I'm just donating my money at that point, right? And that takes some risk. So some of these risks include taking guys above their ADP to ensure that you have the guy that you have, right? You're reaching for a guy that you believe, you know what? Chris Olave is going to be wide receiver 6 on the year. I'm going to take him at 202, right? It looks crazy, but that's the way it does. Or you're drafting QB early to have that positional advantage. Travis Kelce at 103, right?
Yeah. At the end of the day, take your guys. If you believe in them, take them.
Yeah, so the way I kind of viewed this is you're chasing guys like Kelce, and you're structuring your team in kind of a non-traditional manner of going tight end in round 1, QB in round 2, and so on and so forth, which is very difficult to build your team around, but you're playing the upside, right? Like say you're at 104, right? You're taking Kelce to basically solidify the positional advantage of tight end and solidify your competitive edge, and you followed up with a reach and say you grab Mahomes for the stack or Jalen Hurts in the 2nd round. No one else is enticing to you for that amount of point output. And then you hit round 3, you grab Jahmyr Gibbs because statistically running backs drafted above top 5 in the actual NFL draft are massive fanny producers, so on and so forth. Take like a Christian Watson who has a tremendous ceiling. You don't know what he's going to give you week to week, but those boom weeks where he gets you 3 touchdowns and 200 yards, right? Like that's all you need. Yep. Or Mike Williams. Or you start taking bets on rookies who will blossom as the season progresses, kind of pinning it on breakout seasons, playoff pushes, that kind of stuff. So you're basically top loading your team with a bunch of heavy hitters that you know are going to carry you enough, and then hopefully your depth solidifies you as the season goes on based upon these projections that you've done. Like, so if you bought the rookie guide, you understand which rookies are probably going to perform this year based upon our projections of what we've given you.
There we go.
So you're giving up on a top 5 wide receiver, a top 15 running back with this type of play, but the amount of points per positional grouping you're securing is creating a safety bubble of advantage where at the end of the season, 2 of your players will have 150 more points combined than your opponent's other 2 players, right? So you have a Kelce and a Mahomes, they're starting Goff and Higbee. You already have a competitive advantage in regards to that kind of thing.
Correct.
So there's always a caveat to this, just like Death Shadows, you're playing the razor's edge of things don't line up sometimes. Sometimes a rookie doesn't live up to the hype. Sometimes our analysis tries to put a square peg into a round hole, or a team doesn't live up to the projections that you stack as you reached for your Burns and like Russ, and he only throws 55% of his throws accurately. So it's kind of the Icarus method of playing fantasy, of leveraging boom bust to come up with statistically top guys to average more points in this season for the guys that you want to draft in the NFL.
Shoots for the moon. Shoot for the moon, baby.
Yep.
Sixth place is stupid.
Yep.
Don't do it. Before we shift over, that was good. My favorite Magic deck that I played was just all like Brushfire Elementals, and I was just drawing as much mana as possible and just fucking people's worlds up. All right, so let's go to our closing segment. Let's take a trip. Let's go to class. Let's go take our lesson in geography.
So, got some good feedback about last week's segment. Let's do another geography session, all right?
Let's go.
All right, so this week, I tried to look at Interstate 95. Interstate 95 runs from the southern tip of Florida and Miami all the way to the Canadian border in Maine. It runs the entire East Coast, touches all your major cities, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Boston, New York City. But I don't know how this happened, but there's like a customer that we ship to every once in a while, and they're located in the city. And I was like, oh, this city's off of I-95. So I just started looking into it and stuff, and turned out it was one of the, it worked out so perfectly for this podcast. All right. So this week we're going to the Northeast, taking a little shift from the Midwest. We're going to the Northeast. All right. Let's talk about New Haven, Connecticut. All right.
Okay. Okay.
All right. It's the third largest city in Connecticut. Since it's the East Coast, it has a lot of history. You know, it was founded in 1638 by the Puritans. There's a lot of famous landmarks in that city. It was founded at the time, just after New York City, which was known at that time was New Amsterdam. But it was located on a big river and a big port, so they could have a lot of shipping lanes for all their trade and stuff. One of the weird things I saw there is they were like, okay, New Haven, Connecticut is famous for the pizza. I'm like, well, I'm from Chicago, so how famous could this really be, right? So I start looking up like their pizza recipes and their famous pizza out there. Some of it looks really good, but they're like most famous for this like white sauce, like white clam pizza. And I'm like, sorry, that's
keep
not
that
pizza.
Keep that in your chowder.
Yeah, that's just weird. All right.
I accept the fact that people are making stupid decisions about regional culinary dishes, but don't tell me that it's good.
Right, right, right. Some other famous things about this town. Samuel Colt actually invented the automatic revolver in 1836 in this town, and actually led to Connecticut at one time being like the biggest arms manufacturer in the United States.
America.
Yeah, you know, that's where like Springfield Arms is located. I don't think it is anymore. It also had a famous court case. Tony probably knows a lot more than I do about this, but it's the U.S. versus the Amistad. The Amistad, the famous slave ship in the, I don't know, 1800s. The U.S. Supreme Court, where they held this case, was in New Haven, Connecticut. And it was a famous case because it ruled in favor of the indigenous Africans and restored their freedom after the Spanish illegally captured all these people from Sierra Leone. Pretty crazy. Another claim to fame for this town, in 1900, this guy opened this restaurant, I think in 1895. So 5 years after this restaurant opened, Louis Lassen, who this restaurant is still there to this day. It's called Louis Lunch. It's credited by the Library of Congress as inventing the hamburger and the steak sandwich.
Dude, God bless him.
Let's right? go.
Right? And I looked at the menu, and it looks real simple. It's just one of those places, like, you can get a burger, dog, fry, kind of like, what's that place we have in Chicago, Tony?
Portillo's.
No, down the street from the UC, you know, the famous...
oh, Harold's?
Cheeseburger.
Dude.
Fries, no Coke, no Pepsi.
Burger King.
Right. Jim Morrison was also famously arrested for attempting to incite a riot in the New Haven Arena in the 60s, yeah. late 60s.
Imagine doing that. Going to a Doors concert, trying to start a riot.
Ryan, you know goddamn well how I feel about the Doors.
Yeah.
Any band that replaces their bass player with the left hand of a fucking keyboard can kiss my ass.
It was still good, though.
It wasn't.
Let's talk about some famous people from this town, all right? We've got Paul Giamatti, famous star of Sideways and Billions, you know, all cinema for the last 30 years.
Shoot 'em up.
Yeah,
that's a good movie.
That would be so stupid. I love it.
Here's a lesser known name you probably don't know. Paul Fusco. He created the show Alf.
That's like the fifth reference of Alf in this podcast.
Oh my God. He eats cats.
Yeah. We've got Charles Ives, an early 20th century composer. I don't know if you've ever listened to some of his stuff, Tony. I might have shown you stuff in college, but you should check it out. Charles Ives.
Okay.
Here's one for you, Tony. Michael Bolton is from New Haven, Connecticut.
Let's go.
Which one? The one from Office Space or the...
Also, Ernest Borgnine.
Okay.
Is from New Haven, Connecticut. And then as I started going down the rabbit hole with like this whole town, I'm like, how am I going to, you know, make this relevant to football? You know, I was like, well, it looks like Yale University is in New Haven, Connecticut.
Okay.
So let's talk about a guy from New Haven, Connecticut that's basically the inventor of football, Walter Camp.
Yep.
He basically invented the game like from like the 1870s and perfected it until he worked on it until like he died. And I think it was the late 1890s or 1900s. So at the time, Camp was on various collegiate football rules committees that developed the American game from his time as a player at Yale until he died. At the time, they were kind of using like English rugby football rules. So, and that required a tackled player when the ball was fairly held to put the ball down immediately for what they had, what they call in rugby scrummage. But Camp said at the U.S. College Football Rules Convention in 1880 that the contested scrum he replaced with a line of scrimmage where the team with the ball started with uncontested possession. This change effectively created the evolution of the modern game in American football through its rugby football origins.
Damn.
He is credited with innovations such as the snapback from center, the system of downs, the point system, as well as the introduction of what became a standard offense arrangement of players, a 7-man line and a 4-man backfield consisting of a quarterback, 2 halfbacks, and a fullback. Camp was also responsible for introducing the safety, the awarding of 2 points to the defensive side for tackling a ball carrier in his own end zone, followed by a free kick by the offense from its own 20-yard line to restart the play. This is significant as rugby union has no point value award for this action, but instead awards a scrum to the attacking side 5 meters from the goal line. In 2011, reviewing Camp's role in the founding of the sport and of the NCAA, Taylor Branch also credited Camp with cutting the number of players on a football team from 15 down to 11 and adding measuring lines to the field. However, Branch noted that the revelation in a contemporaneous McClure's magazine story of Camp's $100,000 slush fund, along with the concern about the violence of the growing sport, helped lead to the President Teddy Roosevelt's intervention in the sport.
That man's legitimately saved football, Teddy Roosevelt.
The NCAA emerged from the national talks, but worked to Yale's advantage relative to the rival, Roosevelt's alma mater, Harvard. I was so flabbergasted when I was like, I'm looking up all this stuff. I'm like, there's a bunch of, this is where football was invented. I'm like, holy shit. How did I just pick a random city on I-95 and all of a sudden this is where football was invented?
And not only did that guy invent football, but he also probably ate a hamburger at the first ever hamburger place.
He probably went to Louis' Lunch. I'm sure.
I'm saying.
I was reading something about that too, and it's one of those places where they don't put it on a grill. They almost like boil their burgers and then brown them on the outside to cook it all the way through. And I'm guessing that's just, you know, how they did it back in the 1900s because they needed to kill all the bacteria. You couldn't serve.
Yeah.
You couldn't serve medium rare hamburgers.
They had to pick the worms out of it before they fried
right,
it.
Right. Yeah. So that's how they do it to this day. But that is New Haven, Connecticut, the birthplace of football.
I've been geedrified.
Hell yeah.
That was awesome. All right. That's all we got. We ran a little bit long, but we got to indulge ourselves with a fun episode after a long summer of research. So thank you for abiding us and hanging out. Next week, I think we're going to do some fantasy landmines and maybe talk season props, like early betting lines for the season ahead. So sure. Let's plan to come back here next week and hit them with the 96 and more fun stuff as we inch closer and closer to the regular season. We're like 4 weeks away, y'all.
Holy shit. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
All right. So until next week, thank y'all for coming around. Any last words?
Be well.
Ryan?
Do some best balls while you can.
Get them in. All right. Good night, everybody.
Derek Carr.
You fucked my fantasy team by getting into that car accident, dude.